We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking a bit about life in Central Asia and some of the countries that are sometimes known collectively as the Stans. And we're talking about places like Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan. Our guest this morning is Marilyn Davis. She has worked in this region as a consultant for both the U.S. government and also for nonprofit agencies, among them the Urban Institute. And we'll talk a little bit about some of her experiences there, helping local governments build relationships with their people and gear up to provide basic services. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She studied political science and public administration at University of Illinois, has worked in city government here in the United States, in both in Illinois and in Florida, and then went on to do this consulting work that we'll talk about. She's worked for the International City Management Association and the Urban Institute, has worked in the countries that I mentioned, also has done some work in Europe, in Hungary, and Bulgaria, Albania. She lives here in Champaign-Urbana, and we're glad to have her here in studio with us to talk a little bit. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 is the local number. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions, comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I'm just interested in hearing a little bit more about you and starting off with, you know, your interest in government, in studying government. What drew you into the study of public administration in the first place?
It was home raising babies. I dropped out of school. I was a music major initially and became involved with the local League of Women Voters. And through that, it became clear that local government's a fascinating thing and probably affects the daily lives of people more than any other service, any other activity, anything else that goes on in their lives. If the toilets don't flush and the water doesn't run and they can't get down the streets to get to work or their kids can't get an education in school, then we all have problems. And that creates the instability in many of these countries.
Yeah.
So I went on, and when I did go back to school, I finished my undergraduate degree in political science and then in public administration and went on to I worked as an intern in Urbana, as a matter of fact, and then went on from there to work as an assistant in Downers Grove and Skokie. I managed Richton Park and Fossmoor in Illinois, up in the Chicago suburbs, and then Maitland, Florida, which is a suburb of Orlando. And then got bored and decided they were advertising for people to go overseas and work with local governments. And first assignment was in Eastern Hungary. And I tell people I was not in Budapest. I was out in Eastern Hungary in Debrecen on the Romanian border, the Romanian-Ukraine border, working with those local governments shortly after they had really separated and had the Soviets leave. So it was a very different Hungary than it is today. Hmm. Went on from there to Bulgaria. In Hungary, we worked to help those governments create associations to provide joint services for themselves. And they developed, we did one with a lined landfill that serves 44 local governments today, created some small industrial parks that allowed them to bring in development and in foreign investment. Bulgaria worked with training capacity for all of those local governments as they were beginning to have the independence from the central governments. Albania was the same way. And then Tajikistan was a whole different story.
Yeah. Well, the thing I think is really interesting about this it gets you thinking in a very different way about some of the sweeping political changes that we have heard about and talked about now for years, at least going back to the end of the Cold War. And we talk about these big overarching issues, and while those are important things to think about and talk about, then, though, you've got to put yourself in the mind of local governments in places like this, where now they have very practical, immediate concerns that they have to deal with, as you talked about. They have to say, well, who's going to collect the trash? And what are we going to do with it?
And how do we make sure that... who's going to pay for it?
You know, all these things. And so I can see that they it would be very important for them to have somebody who had that kind of expertise at a parallel kind of level. When you're talking about a municipal government of that size, I'm sure they would just have all kinds of very basic questions. Like, well, how exactly do we do this? This before, somebody else worried about this before. Well, now it's our problem. How do we do this?
That's exactly right. And the problems are really very, very basic. The delivery of water, the collection of sewage, which is practically unknown in the post-Soviet countries, the collection of trash, which broke down completely after the separation from Soviet Union, because there was no money now to repair trucks, there was no money now to buy gas. Everything started to cost, where during the Soviet period there was no, quote, cost really to anything. And suddenly, the people themselves were without the services that they had always simply relied on, because they kind of came from, like manna, from the central government.
Mm-hmm.
So putting together initially those services. And then all of these countries also came out of the post-Soviet system, where the central government controlled things. And although there were local councils that were elected in most of these countries, those local councils had no authority to do anything. Their primary role was to liaison with the people and tell the people what the government had decided and what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about about Central Asia. This is a part of what used to be the Soviet Union. These were republics of the Soviet Union. And I don't know that we really, during Soviet times, probably didn't hear a great deal about what happened in these places. And even since, if news comes out of one of these places, it's because there's conflict there, and that's kind of our orientation. And I'm sure that it's a part of the world that is a complete mystery probably to most people, unless they've been there or unless they've studied it.
It's most of these countries, the Silk Road essentially ran through this area. It came out of China or India and came through Uzbekistan, through Tajikistan. Hoshent was a major, major transit area for the Silk Road. And then it traveled on through there up into Russia. Today, our primary interests in it are that Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan all have major reserves of gas and oil. Tajikistan is the only country that really does not have any resources, except they have 80% of the water from that region within their borders and control. However, they've not been able to get their act together, if you want to call it that, at the government level, to really capitalize on that. And so, although they have the water, it becomes a source of irritation with their neighbors, particularly Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. Then they don't have the money to pay for the power that comes from Uzbekistan, so Uzbekistan turns it off, and then, and the government says, well, the Uzbeks are being mean. But the fact is they haven't paid their bills, so they're not going to get the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting area. And then another, of course, major interest for us is that the border of the southern border of Tajikistan, the southern border is Afghanistan. There's 1,700 miles of Afghanistan. The eastern border is China, Tibet, Mongolia. Turkmenistan on the other side, their eastern border is Iran, and their southern border is Afghanistan. And Kazakhstan is in the middle of all of that. And when you look at the gas and oil reserves that are sandwiched between Afghanistan, China, and Iran, you begin to think in terms of what our own political interests are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that a lot of people, that's a question many people will go right to, and will want to know about even if you were you're working for a non-governmental organization, there I'm sure that there will be suspicion, and there may be suspicion on the part of the people who live in the place where you are, and maybe even also suspicion of people in the United States when they hear about something like this, that what you're doing is you're carrying out the agenda of the United States government, or that you're somehow supporting the political agenda of the government. And of course, the United States wants to have friends, and if we have strategic energy resources, that's an important thing for us to have an interest in. How do you see what you do being connected with what it is the United States government is interested in?
Well, in addition to the resources, mm-hmm. The stability of the world is something that we do find in our best interests, and it is in our own individual personal best interests. The kinds of conflict that can go on disrupts everything. Look at Afghanistan. I mean, look at Iraq. That kind of conflict is disrupting us personally here in the States. As I said at the very beginning, though, local governments and the ability of people to have basic services and some control over what those services are is a basic stabilizing factor in a country. If the people have enough to eat, their kids are getting an education, they have a way to support themselves, they have water, they have access to water. In these countries, 50% of the people do not have direct access to water. They literally have to go somewhere else to get water, to bring it home in buckets, to bring it home in any kind of a container they can get. It's a very common thing to see along the rivers and the drainage ditches. Children, there'll be a couple of donkeys and there'll be big, like, milk canisters or buckets or whatever. Children will be bringing the water home that in the morning, and then the same thing happens in the afternoon. So that water is, and then it's the water from the drainage ditches or the rivers that are so badly polluted. So the water goes back, and then you have endemic diseases. I had someone at one point say to me when I was complaining about my own intestinal distress, they said, well, you know, it's spring. It's diarrhea season. Well, everybody gets it. It's spring. Like, it's a very normal part of life. It's normal for children to have worms. It is normal for children to have the kinds of things that we would just never, ever consider normal in our children.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Marilyn Davis. She is someone who has worked as a consultant for both the government and also for nonprofit agencies. And I mentioned some that she's worked with: the Urban Institute, the International City Management Association. She has experience in city government and has worked in cities here in the state of Illinois and in Florida. And then she said at one point she kind of got bored, and so she turned her attention to doing this kind of work elsewhere, and has worked in Europe. She's been in Hungary and Ukraine. She lived for a number of years in Tajikistan, has also been in Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. And we're talking a little bit about some of the things that she has done and this kind of consulting work. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here we have a caller to bring into the conversation here in Champaign County, where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. The ambassador from the UK to Uzbekistan has some interesting perspectives on this too. I think it's Craig Murray, but he's all over the internet. If you want to find out what he thinks about at least his Uzbeki experience. So I just wanted to put that out for people to be able to look at. He resigned in disgust at the Western support for our useful dictator there. But you brought up the oil, and the curious turn of phrase was, we have strategic energy reserves there or something. Well, they have them, and we've been looking at them. I was, if you watch the end of the Cold War and the bipartisan avarice for that area, the bloom is kind of blown because I guess it's a little more difficult to get it out, and there isn't quite as much as they speculated at first. But people like James Baker, the former Secretary of State for Bush 1, was on this the Chamber of Commerce that was established right after they were looking to open this up. But basically, the energy is what should be up front as far as the discussion and the U.S. role in these so-called stable regimes. I think is really important. I was arguing at the time of the Kosovo and Balkan intervention that part of the reason for that was basically to have what the Pentagon uses, the discourse, lily pads, to have a base close into that region. And I really think that's true. I think in grand area strategy, that's partially what the U.S. is about there. And that's Bonsteel is the name of the base there. It's, one of the 800 or 1,000 bases around the world. That one has the extra benefit of actually nominally being a NATO base, but it's really a U.S. base and is used in the region. Well, anyway, there's no question there, but I just wanted people to sort of take that sort of neo-imperial analysis into mind when they're thinking about the stands and a pipeline of stands. Some of them are important just because they're in between various places where the energy needs to go as well. So, again, not a question, but I don't know exactly how you'll react to
well, we get in and give an opportunity the guests to react.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't really deal with the issues of gas and oil and embassies and bases. The only country that I really work in that has a base is Kyrgyzstan, and that's not part of my portfolio today. The Manas base there is a primary transit base for us into Afghanistan. The French do have a base in Tajikistan where they ferry things for us and the other country, any other country that has an interest into Afghanistan. But I have, as I said, I have very little knowledge, only what I hear on the street when I'm there. But my focus tends to be at the local government level again. And where I come into contact with these central governments is that so much of the control and the services are controlled by the local by the central governments yet. In virtually every country, the primary cities, the mayors of the primary cities are appointed by the president, and they report directly to the president. Tajikistan just passed legislation that allows the minor areas, the jamaats, to elect their own mayors and so on. However, the regional governor has the authority to replace him. So you could have him elected, but the regional government has the authority to replace him. Mm. So that's my usual contact with the ministries and with the parliament is in the development of legislation that would strengthen the control at local levels.
Yeah. Well, just for the kind of work that you've done, say if you're working, say, for an organization like the Urban Institute.
One question. Today I work for Cardno.
Oh, okay.
A different company. This is a different company. Cardno is an Australian-owned company, but has its base here in the United States in Washington.
All right. So that I guess my question is, who ultimately is paying the bills? Where does the money come from that pays your salary and people
pays
who do
me?
Like
that? Yeah. Cardno has a contract with USAID and the State Department to provide my services to these countries. So it's a contractual arrangement. Mm-hmm. And USAID and the State Department both have to sign off on me. In this case, they suggested that I would be an acceptable person to them. I guess because I now have been there so long, I have pretty decent relationships with those central governments. But then my paycheck comes from Cardno. Cardno has the contract with USAID to provide these services. We use short-term technical assistance for things like water, someone to come in and help us do a feasibility or an assessment on what we need, what we can do to increase the water supply or to just provide water for our community. We have consultants who work with us on trash collection and garbage and landfills. We've built, using USAID funds, we have built landfills in, golly, I think in Tajikistan we've built probably 8 or 10 of them now. Mm-hmm. To collect the garbage and have it managed so that it's not an environmental problem, which it has been in the past. There are programs also in all of these countries that work with the agricultural sectors to reduce, to increase the product, that the grain, to increase the amount of money or of food that is grown internally. Today in Tajikistan, 80% of its food is imported. Even though they do have some areas, primarily the ag areas, the 6% of arable land they have is primarily used for cotton.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the, and I don't mean to suggest that it's, you know, either good or bad or otherwise, but the point is that ultimately that it is an effort that it's funded by the United States.
Yes, it is.
Government.
Yes, it is. Okay. Yeah.
We are at about our midpoint here, and questions are certainly welcome. I got another caller I'll get to. I think we'll continue to talk with Marilyn Davis. She's worked as a consultant, both with U.S. government and nonprofit agencies, helping local government do development of some very basic services. And we've talked about kind of some of the things that she's been involved in places like Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. She's also worked in Hungary and Ukraine, Bulgaria, Albania. She's been doing this kind of work for a number of years. Her academic background is in political science and public administration, and she's worked in village and city management in Illinois and in Florida, and then went on to do this kind of work. And as I've mentioned, she has worked for the International City Management Association, the Urban Institute, and now Cardno is the...
Cardno EMG, Cardno Emerging Markets.
And this is an international development kind of company?
Yes. All right. And most of their work is in the health sector and the agricultural sector,
And all around the world.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a lot of. They're all through Central Asia. They have a lot of work in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They have a large number of projects in Africa. There are some projects in South America.
All right. We'll talk next with a caller here in Paw Paw, up in the northern part of the state, line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, I think this is kind of a far-fetched idea, to be honest with you. I'm not saying I'm not advocating don't help these people at all, but do they really want to become an independent country and be like us, so to speak? I know people that have been over there and have studied this as a curriculum, and they're observation is basically leave them alone. There's a lot of people who won't talk to a lot of Americans if they know you're American. Of course, we're white skinned, so it's kind of hard to hide. But there's a lot of people that in the majority of the country thinks that we're in the wrong place and we should leave them alone. So the reason I say this is because it seems like we're spending an awful lot of time and money setting up countries or trying to help them get on with life, and yet we've got a big problem in this country. We're trying to take care of our deficit. And if you look at how much money this country spends outside of it, taking care of other people's problems, I mean, after all, we are paying for you guys to be over there. You know, the federal government, I'm getting kind of a little disturbed because it seems like we're giving freebies to people that don't deserve it.
Okay,
and
let's get
the wrong step.
Well, let's get a response here, because I think that, you know, whenever you talk about generally the subject of foreign aid, that is the amount of money that the U.S. government spends trying to help other countries, completely aside from the amount of money that we're spending that's defense related. That's the kind of thing that people always raise questions about. Now, I think it's also true that as a percentage of the U.S. budget, it's a very small amount of money.
At or under 1%.
Now, that, you know, some people might, for them, that might still be too much. They might say, well, that should be zero. I don't know. But how, you know, how do you, I wonder how you,
well,
you think about that.
Let's talk about, first of all, the kind of thing that I do is to go in and we bring in technical expertise to assist them in bringing a water system up to standards or in methods of collecting the trash that are less expensive. We also work with building recognition that the citizens have some say and some right in that. We look at any system that we take in, we look at the sustainability of it through local resources. So that when we work with them on the collection of trash, we also work with the citizens on the fact that they have an obligation to pay for that service. We provide what we've always kind of called jumpstart or kickstart grants, which will allow them. From the time, if you have a system that has no money in it, but it needs infrastructure, there's a period of time where you can convince people to pay for it. But what they say is, I'll pay for it if I get the service. So if you ask them to start paying for it, to pay for the infrastructure, there's a gap between the time they're paying and the time they get the service, a significant gap. So what we have been doing is covering that gap. We provide the technical assistance. We might buy a truck. We might buy some bins for the collection of the garbage. We do work with the local government to do the citizen education on the payment for it. But the service can start now while the people can begin to pay for it. And then the service is sustainable because they are paying for it when we leave. Mm-hmm. And that's the goal, is to make it sustainable. To his question about people not wanting it, when I first started doing this, I met with a man named Ted Priftis from USAID. And one of the things that Ted said to me is, it's important for us to remember, in this particular kind of thing, in aid, in USAID work, that we are not necessarily there just to try to change the hearts and minds of people. We are there to work with people who want their country to improve. And in the process of that, hearts and minds get changed. Mm-hmm. But you have to start with the people who want the changes. And those are the folks I get to work with. So I have a different perspective than folks who go in and try to convince people to do something that they have no interest in or no need for. Hmm.
Well, generally speaking, when you meet people and they know that you're an American, that you're from the United States, what sort of response do you get? And have you had to deal with anti-American sentiment at some of the places where you've been?
I've never had to deal with anti-American sentiment. Hmm. We are at least in my experience, we have had people who want us there, who want to come here, who want to be part of us, who want to know how we do it. How did we ever get to be like this? Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about us. I've had people confront me with, well, you know, nobody in your country who isn't white can have anything. They don't have any jobs. They don't have any food. They're all starving. They're all living out on the streets. And trying to overcome that, saying, yes, we have some problems. We do have that. But no, the bulk of our people live rather comfortably. And at the same time, to not flash it in their face about how wealthy this country really is.
I wonder, can you talk just, I'm really interested in having a little bit more of a, say, an example of a particular problem. That is, you're going to a particular place and they have some issue, and whether it's water or it's garbage collection or, you know, whatever it is. They say, look, this is a real important service. We've got to figure out how we're going to do this. Right. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about, you know, what,
how do we do that?
How you do it. I mean, you know, what is it they want to know? What sort of questions do they ask? And how it is that you try to help them deal with something that is a very practical kind of basic thing, and I'm sure it's the kind of thing that we kind of take for granted.
Well, let's talk about the community of Yavan in Tajikistan. Yavan, when we first went there, the garbage wasn't being collected. It was literally piling up outside of these apartment buildings and outside and in the streets and so on. And when we sat down with the mayor, and then we sat down with small groups of people and said, what are your big problems? What are your priorities? It was garbage and water, garbage and water. And at that time, we really didn't have funds to do water, because that's a far more expensive issue. But we worked with Yvonne to develop a five-year infrastructure recovery plan, and started with garbage and started with the citizens. We developed citizen groups that supported the idea of having the garbage collected on a regular basis and putting the garbage in bins. We jointly funded the cost of buying bins with the government. The government then bought a truck using some funds that they managed to get as a grant from the central government. We provided them with technical assistance on how to calculate how many bins you need. Believe it or not, that's not easy if you've never done it. What would be the most efficient routing, how often the garbage had to be collected. We gave them technical assistance in identifying a place where the garbage could be put that had impermeable soils where it would not leak into the water systems. And we provided them with technical assistance in terms of developing the costs of those services and then in educating the people about the cost and the payment for those fees, set up a fee system for them. Today, Yvonne, and this is now about 5 years later, this has not happened, so it doesn't happen overnight. That whole trash system is a self-sustaining system. And they pay for it themselves. They collect the garbage every day. They cover their garbage out at the landfill on a weekly basis. And it is a far cleaner system. Today they've asked us to work with them on water. And it seems that the central government gave them enough money to bring water from a source 7.5 kilometers toward the town, but that was about 1.5 kilometers short. And so they're now talking about how we can get water to them. We're looking at the possibility of an overhead tank for gravity so that it doesn't have to be used pumps for our 24-hour pumping for the system. And we'll do all of that with technical assistance and, again, with these Jumpstart grants. Hmm.
Well, and the kind of work that you describe with helping them figure out how to collect the garbage and how many and giving people bins and figuring out
how much
did it cost? I mean, how much was expended in just kind of getting the
in USAID money?
Getting it kind of set up and teaching them what they need to know and kind of getting it rolling.
Okay, this is a community of 28,000 people. Our grant expenditures in that community was about $30,000 over a period of 5 years. In addition to that, we did a tremendous amount of training and capacity building with the local staff and with citizens. And I honestly couldn't put a number on that. But it's certainly not what it would cost to even run one major seminar here in the country.
$30,000 over
5 years.
5 years. That strikes me as being an extraordinarily small amount.
It is.
As things go, a very small amount
it
of money.
Is. And in addition to that, because we managed to work with a local a local steel company to design and produce the bins, we also helped support a small local industry that now has been making bins for other cities around the country. Yvonne and about 6 or 8 other communities have become kind of magnets where officials from other communities will come in and study how they do it, and they're now starting to provide that as a service, and it's spread out to the point where this kind of a garbage system is probably in 30 or 35 communities in Tajikistan. Yeah.
We have another caller here we'll get on to, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes in this hour of focus. We're talking with Marilyn Davis. She has, for a number of years now, been working as an independent consultant in international development. She has experience here doing city management work here in Illinois. She's also worked in Florida, has done consulting with the government, the U.S. government, also with nonprofits like the Urban Institute. She's now working for a company called Cardinal, which is an Australian-based international kind of development organization that does work in a lot of different countries around the world. And she herself has been in Europe, in Hungary, in Ukraine, in Bulgaria, Albania, also has spent a number of years in Tajikistan, has also worked in spent time in Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, doing the kind of work that we've talked about here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. And you can email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have some other callers here. They're in Champaign. We'll start in again with line one. Right here. Yes. Hello. Yes.
Yes. Hi. I just wanted to address the last caller's concerns and comments a little bit because I feel the same way. You know, you spend a lot of money on different foreign things, and then we have a lot of problems at home. But in terms of these kinds of programs, what he needs to realize is that it's kind of the old adage, if you teach a person to fish and it feeds them for a lifetime. I mean, by providing these types of programs for some of these countries, our benefit is that those countries, it helps make them more stable, their communities more stable. It helps decrease pollution issues that affect the whole world. It also, in many cases, I think these kind of programs provide a higher quality of life for the women in those countries. And there have been numerous studies that have shown when you increase the education and the quality of life for women in particularly third world countries, that all kinds of positive things happen, that you decrease infant mortality rate, you decrease birth rates, all kinds of other problems that do cost money. And so these kind of programs really, in the end, do turn around and benefit us by making these other countries have a higher and a better standard of living. You know, they're just more stable, and they contribute less to global problems and global pollution and all of that. So I think these kind of programs really do have a very effective and positive outcome.
All right.
Thank you. I would absolutely agree with her. And particularly, again, as we said, we were talking before about the minimal investment that we really make in these kinds of programs.
As you go around it and doing your work, are there in local government in these places, are there women who are in local government, or are they pretty much all men that you're dealing with?
Well, no, there are women, and there are more and more women, which is really kind of interesting. There are women who are elected to these councils. There are women who are extremely interested in what's going on. I've seen more and more women being appointed to positions within the government. When I first started going over there in 2002, the women that you met in the government were in one sector. They were social education sector, period. That's the only place you ever saw them. But they were always there, and it was a Soviet policy that would be a woman's ministry. Today, they are everywhere. You see them throughout the Ministry of Finance. You see them throughout the economic sectors. You see them through Parliament. You do see them as local government mayors and on the councils. So, yes, there is a significantly increasing role.
All right. Well, let's talk with another caller. I think this is almost also someone in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you started off the program in terms of not paying for things and such, but we sort of forget what this mindset's like, where, you know, the Soviets are paying for all this stuff, it's free, and all of a sudden now you got to pay for it. So I think I saw a documentary, and I don't know which of the countries where it was in, but it had to do with energy. And what happened was that, you know, it was always paid for, and what happened is they run around, they don't want to pay for it, and I don't know what big energy company came in, whether, you know, trying to get a system going, but, you know, it was all short-circuiting, you know, in terms of around the grid and the whole bit. So can you explain sort of that experience, or are you familiar with, in terms of the difficulty with energy?
Energy is a huge, huge question because, as you said, under the Soviets, there was no cost to that. It was simply provided, and it was used in ways we would never really think about it. For instance, where the water systems are all pumped 24 hours a day, there are no gravity systems in these places. And people did not, they paid for it, but it was a very, very small amount that really didn't matter. But then when the Soviets left, many of electricity, gas, et cetera, were all privatized. And the people who bought them expected to make a profit. And they expected at least to cover their costs. And, of course, the rates at that time did not cover it. But then the people, when you talk about 30, 40, 50% of the people living under the poverty line in their country, you have to make adjustments both in terms of how power is used, how much people pay for it, and convince people that paying for it is in their best interest. It is a huge educational issue on both sides, and one that we have done some work with, but I primarily have done it at the levels of garbage, water, sewage, streets, roads, parks, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. But even at that level, it's tough.
All right. Again, well, I think the call is going to another listener here, someone in Indiana, Kevland, Indiana, our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about when the Soviet Union withdrew, and I'm trying to understand the ethnic cleansing or something going on in the stands, especially Uzbekistan. What percentage of the Russians that had been imported originally under the Tsars remains? I mean, the blondes, you know, big Russian people and the darker native peoples. And is that part of the reason there was such, upheaval? And that's the first question. The second question is, what percentage of their economy is in mining specifically for these new micro minerals that will be technologically very important to us in the future? I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
All right.
I think one of the things when we talk about the ethnic issues throughout Central Asia and, in fact, in many of the other countries that were developed under Stalin drew the lines of Central Asian countries and the republics in such a way, first of all, you had to have 1 million people in order to name it a republic. So borders were gerrymandered to allow that. Secondly, he really believed that in the divide-and-conquer theory of ethnic issues. And so the lines were drawn to divide the Uzbeks from the Kyrgyz, to divide the Uzbeks from the Tajiks, to divide the Tajiks from the Afghans, to divide everybody up. And as things happened, for instance, Hojent went to Tajikistan so that they could have their 1 million people, but Hojent had always been an Uzbek city. And when one ethnic group loses something as important as the city of Hojent, there's going to be conflict and be a dislike. And what happens under this whole Stalin era is that was all suppressed. You weren't allowed to be upset about it, but it never went away. You know, Grandpa told the grandchild, and the grandchild grew up and told his grandchildren, and everybody knew that Hoshant had been stolen. So you have that. That's just one very small example of what went on with all of that. And that is still ingrained there. And it still causes those kinds of issues. So that's one of those. The question in terms of resources, I'll tell you, the best source to go find out who has what resources and what percentage of their income and so on is the CIA World Factbook. It's online. It's updated almost, I swear they must update it monthly. But it will tell you, and it's very basic information, it is not political propaganda. It will tell you what the natural resources are. It will tell you what the population breakdown is. It will tell you what the issues are in those countries, in any country in the world. and it probably is the best source.
Hmm. And just, I don't know if this, again, I suppose it's something that you could, one could easily look up, but since the caller raised the question, do you have some idea about what percentage in, say, in Central Asia now, the countries we're talking about, what percentage of the population is ethnic Russian?
It depends on the country. In Tajikistan, most of the Russians left during the Civil War. In Turkmenistan, Russians are a very common, very obvious part of the population and a very integrated portion of the population. The other countries vary all the way through. So it just really depends on what the economic situation was, why they stayed or they didn't stay.
Hmm. All right. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. We have a caller in Effingham. We'll go there, line number four. Hello.
Yes, I'll get right to the point. I think what your guest is talking about and overall is a neo-colonialism that is now being practiced around the world under patriarchal auspices, if I can use that word. And if your guest has watched or knows about one of the latest POV programs in Kenya, where an American millionaire, billionaire, is there taking the only other swampland on Earth outside of Illinois and turning it into rice fields. And he'll sell back or he's going to hugely profit. And meanwhile, the locals are going bust. The little 40-acre farmer and all those people, just like the U.S., are going to soon be history. Thank you.
I have no knowledge at all of the Kenya project. I just don't know. I do know that in most of these countries, the farms are still central government owned, and very often they're owned by a ministry or whatever. There is a lot of work being done for agricultural reform to allow for more privately owned farms, but that's a very, very long-range, difficult arrangement to turn that back. But most of these countries in Central Asia are protecting their agricultural land from foreign investment rather than encouraging it.
Well, I guess, yeah, and I suppose it's not surprising that we keep coming back to this point because it's something that people do worry about and think about. I suppose whenever you look at international development work that's being, even if it's being done by NGOs, if it's being financed by the U.S. government, I suppose there are some people who are always going to worry, well, okay, what's really the hidden agenda here? And I guess, though, all I can do is continue to come back and ask you, well, for the people that you deal with, what it is they're looking for, what do they think that this is all about? And are they happy to have you there doing what you do, or do you get any kind of a feeling that they think that you're some sort of a stalking horse for American imperialism?
No, I never have had the sense that they think I'm a stalking horse for American imperialism. The people that we work with and the kinds of things I do are truly wanted, and there's a recognition that they were left without this kind of technical knowledge, that they were not moved forward in technical expertise under the Soviets, and that the gap from the time they had left the Soviets from 91 on, they didn't have the knowledge or the ability to do it. And many of those programs were run by Russian experts who did go home. You know, they were expats like I am in many ways, and they did go home. Mm-hmm. And between the loss of the income and the loss of the technical support, those countries now, yes, they are looking for it, and they do support it. Turkmenistan is interesting in that they are wealthy enough that what they have said is, we don't need your money, just send your technical expertise to us. Just tell us how to do it, and we'll pay for it.
Uh-huh. So what sort of things are you involved in now? You're going to be going back sometime soon?
I leave a week from today. They pack me out. That means they come and they pack up all my stuff and put it on the boat to send it over there. On Monday, I get on an airplane Thursday morning. I will arrive in Tajikistan on Monday morning. And I will be working as the American Policy Advisor and in capacity development and training for local governments in Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm.
And how long you expect this assignment's going to be?
This contract is 2.5 years.
2.5 years.
Yeah.
And
I do get to come home from time to time, but not very often.
Yeah. That must be an odd way to live. I suppose there are a lot of people who do that if they're in development work. They work in government and so forth. They spend long periods of time like that away from home.
Well, I look at it this way. I tried retiring for a whole year and a half. And, you know, and yeah, I enjoyed it. And I was kind of getting into being home and being around and having only to go to the grocery when you wanted to buy something and not have to buy everything that was there if they happened to have it in the market. But it's interesting. It's fun. It's the people are absolutely wonderful to work with. They're fascinating. They're family-oriented. They are gentle people. And I know that is at odds with what we have been taught, but the fact is that not everybody is a 20-year-old terrorist, and not everyone is a 50-year-old supporting the terrorist. They are raising their families. They are wonderful people.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Marilyn Davis. She has a lot of experience here as an independent consultant. She's worked for the U.S. government, also nonprofits. We've talked about some of her work in Europe and particularly some of her work in Central Asia. She works now for the international development organization Cardno, and she will soon be going back and spending a couple of years there. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. We appreciate
it.